From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when a phone call changed everything for a group of friends. And that group is the popular improv comedy team known as The Commune. That phone call came from Weekend Live. Not Saturday Night Live, mind you. What do you want to get sued? This is fiction, but stay with me here. Weekend Live was calling to offer a job to one of the improv team members. Have you ever been in this situation in your life? A friend enjoys a breakthrough, which is cause for celebration, but it's juxtaposed with the frustration and stagnation felt by the rest of the group, who maybe haven't experienced the same success. This is the story at the heart of a new film from comedian Mike Birbiglia. I saw it last night at the Little Theater, where you can see it this week. Film critic Sheila O'Malley called the film beautiful and sneakily profound, and I think she's right. It is not a film just about improv, although you will certainly see what life is like inside that world. It's a film about human relationships and how fragile but vital our friendships are. So this hour, I thought we would not only explore some of the themes in the film from the friendship side, but have a little fun as we do talk about some of the core tenets of improv. We're going to say yes and this hour as we welcome our guests. In studio, John Forrest Thompson is here. He's an educator, improviser, creative consultant. He performs with the group Thank You Kiss. He trained at I.O. Chicago. It's nice to have you here, John.
Ah, thank you for having me.
And it's I.O., right?
It is.
It used to be Improv Olympics, but right now we don't want to get sued, so we call it I.O.
That's Chicago. Correct.
Okay,
yes.
I just want to make sure we're all clear here. And Caitlin Drago's here. She's the owner of Inspire Improv and Coaching. You trained at Upright Citizens Brigade in L.A., yes?
Yes.
Well, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And we have a couple of people who are kind of a big deal in this world, and great to have on the phone with us Liz Allen. She's an improv coach and author. And Liz, as I have read, and maybe you can correct me on this, but not only did you work with Mike Birbiglia years ago, but he brought you in to work with the actors in this film, yes? Is that right? Oh, I lost Liz. Okay, Liz, if you're there, hang there. Let me just turn to the other guest we have on the phone, and that's Jeffrey Sweet. He is a playwright, a performer, and author of the book Something Wonderful Right Away, which everybody I know in the improv world tells me is on that must-read list. So I think we've got Jeffrey. Are you there, Jeffrey?
I am indeed.
Great to have you. Thank you for taking the time for us.
It's a pleasure.
And Jeffrey, I think we saw your book at multiple junctures during the film last night, some of the characters thumbing through it. And just your take on the film, just sort of generally speaking, what did you think of the movie, Jeffrey?
I thought it was terrifically accurate. I've been hanging around and observing and part of the improv world since, I guess the mid-70s. I'm old. And it's very, very accurate. Frequently when you see people trying to do films about improv or trying to do films about jazz, there's an air of phoniness about it. But this was it. This is really what it's like.
Caitlin Drago, you agree with that?
I do. I thought it was very accurate and like you said, very human too. And, you know, really touching on those group and friendship dynamics that come into play when you're in that situation where everyone is reaching for their dreams and someone gets it and no one else does.
And, you know, I was reading a profile on Caitlin Drago. You might have seen it recently in the Democrat and Chronicle as a woman to watch. You said something that was interesting there. You said the biggest challenge you have overcome was that you moved back to Rochester initially a little afraid that after spending most of your 20s in L.A., if you moved back here, it would mean that technically you failed. And I thought that was a really bluntly honest thing for you to say. But it turns out I think a lot of people in the world that you work in have those fears, yeah?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, and you face a lot of people thinking that you're nuts for going for it. And so you feel even more pressure to make it or else everyone else was right for saying that, oh, no, you can't do that. That's crazy. What are you thinking? And so it adds that extra bit of, oh, no, but I got to do this. And some kinds can steal away some of the joy that comes from simply producing art.
Well, the good news is you don't have to feel alone with that. It's not only an improv thing. Sergei Prokofiev moved in 1918 to the United States after the release of his first symphony. Everybody thought he was going to be a huge hit here. Didn't really work out. And in 1920, he said, I cannot go back to Russia, a failure. I'm moving to Paris. So this is an age-old issue. I just thought the film really made it sort of hit home some of that friction that can happen when you have one person kind of moving ahead, others sort of, not only maybe other parts of the group, John, are thinking, I'm not even sure I want to be on this show. You know, I'm not even sure. We don't all have the same goals here. And in real life, have you seen those tensions?
Yeah, absolutely. I, even with myself, I grew up in Chicago, Had a job in corporate America first and then found improv later. Spent a lot of time trying to make it. And but at the end, I really wanted to marry my wife. So I don't think that she would, you know, she would have supported me either way. It was just a much easier sell. But I think I eventually found my calling. I kind of realized, I probably am not going to be on Saturday Night Live, but I love the teaching aspect of it and the paying it forward that way. So, you know, for me, it was okay to move away from it. It was hard, but I definitely, I still miss it and that camaraderie and that whole subculture. But in a way, it was a little easier to walk away knowing I'd bring it with me.
How does your wife feel about improv and comedy?
You know, she loves it. She is a harsh critic because she doesn't come from that world, which is great. One of the things in the movie, you know, they do bits. You know, if you hang around a lot of improvisers, it becomes a bit, and they could last 10 years. My wife didn't really appreciate being there with 20 people and going through bit after bit. It gets a little exhausting, I think, hanging around with improvisers all the time. So.
You're nodding, Kaylin. You agree with
yes,
that?
Yes, I do.
All right, let me also bring in Liz Allen, who I think we have on the phone now. She's an improv coach and author. Are you there, Liz?
Still conspicuous by her absence.
Yeah. Are you there, Liz? Can we hear you?
Yeah, I hear you. I don't know if you can hear me.
Oh, there we are. We've got you. Sorry about that. Thank you for making the connection, Liz. And so let me reintroduce you not only as an improv coach and author, but for this film, I have read in various places that you had a relationship with Mike Birbiglia, or basically you created his comedic talent years ago, and he brought you in.
So far. Keep going.
There you go. This is good. And then he brought you in for this film to work with the actors. Is that right?
Yes, that's accurate. I was so honored. Mike called and asked me if I could coach improv to this cast. And I did meet Mike when he was a freshman, I think, in college at Georgetown, and I taught him one workshop for 3 hours. So I take total credit for his career. That seems reasonable.
Now, in this film, Liz, there are half a dozen actors, Mike and five others in this group. How many of those six had improv experience before you worked with them?
Well, the four had had improv experience: Tammy Sager, Keegan-Michael Key, Chris Gethard, and Mike, of course. And then Gillian Jacobs and Kate Micucci are actresses and have worked hard, you know, to learn their craft of acting. And along the road had studied improv, but not in the kind of long-form, ensemble-building manner that the other four have done and what I coach. So those were the two that were the newest to improv.
We're talking to Liz Allen. Jeffrey Sweet's on the phone with us. He's a playwright, performer, and author of the book Something Wonderful Right Away. In studio, Caitlin Drago and John Forrest Thompson are here. We're talking about improv and friendship and the way those things dovetail in this new film by Mike Birbiglia. You can see it at the Little Theater now. We saw it last night, and the film is called Don't Think Twice. And we're going to get to the name of the title, the reason for the title, in a moment, because we're going to kind of work through some of the tenets of improv and in some ways how they dovetail with friendship. But let me kind of go back to Liz for just a second here. When you're working with these actors, when you've got two of them who have not been in the improv world, I wouldn't have been able to pick it out as a viewer, Liz. I really did go into that film very curious to see how it would be portrayed in the film. And then I found myself wondering as it went, are these scenes actually improv? Because they look so much like, I don't know, real improv, authentic improv. And I figured, well, some of them had to be scripted. But I've also read that may not be true. How did these scenes come together for the film?
Well, a lot of it and most of it is completely scripted. And it's a real sort of compliment to Mike's writing, how strong the scenes are, that they seem improvised and they're acted so beautifully, they seem improvised. So my understanding is Mike filmed a lot of the scripted scenes, but then he let these people fly and improvise with their skill set as these characters. So, you know, I think there's a mix back and forth, which is how they came together. But it originated very strongly on the page, which is why I think that then the improv became so strong when it's grounded so well at first in writing.
And Liz, while we were getting you hooked up with this conversation, we were talking to the other guests about their initial take on the film. And I think there's been so much praise for this film because it is so human. I would only add, it is really human. There are parts of it that are really tough. Unflinchingly real when it comes to envy, the dynamics of friendship, and walking out of there, everybody sort of had this dazed look on their face, and the theater kind of had this mix of emotions. How did you feel about it?
I feel exactly the same way, and that's precisely why I love it so much. Mike does not sugarcoat the world of improv or even just the competition that goes on in groups of people, whether they're astronauts or improvisers. We all compete in groups, even though we have to work together in groups. And the film struck me the same way. Even when I read it, I was so happy because he's not going to gloss over what's so difficult about competing as an artist. I love it. It hits improv on the head. It's so awkward, and that's beautiful to me. And being an improviser is difficult. It's a challenging life choice, and I love that this movie shows it because it doesn't just make it sound like or look like it's all fun and games. It's very emotionally draining. We're doing personal-based art form, and then we're trying to commercialize it and make a living and raise families. It's a,
can
it's
I add
a
something
lot
in here
different
because,
of a proposition, I think, than it appears from the outside.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Well, actually, this is sort of a later development in improv because the early people who were improvising back in the 50s and 60s with the Compass and Second City, most of them thought this was just something they were screwing around with until it went into their real lives. And it really wasn't until Saturday Night Live came along and Second City started being seen as a feeder to Saturday Night Live that the really sort of, I'm not going to say cutthroat because very few of the people are really mean, but that the competition really kicked in. Up till that point, and I know a lot of the original people, and I know a lot of the people who, you know, were there in the early days, it was a lot of the people had no intention of going into show business at all. They were just doing this for a few years till they went on to become professors or academics or doing something else. So
I love that.
This really changed when Saturday Night Live kicked in. And all of a sudden, people started going to Second City and looking at that as an on-ramp onto Saturday Night Live. And in a weird way, the tail wagged the dog. Because
John,
all of a sudden,
so
the Second City started changing because people wanted to use it to get onto SNL. And they started coming up with their characters and their catchphrases. And it sort of changed Second City. It's still good. It's still funny. But it's indeed a different world than the one that was created by the people who created improv to begin with.
John Forrest Thompson wants to weigh in on that. Go
yeah,
ahead, John.
You know, it's interesting. I came from the corporate world prior to going into improv, and one of the things I did at I.O. as a house manager, and they would have Lorne Michaels come for those showcases. And, you know, the difference is in corporate America, you saw a lot of people rooting against people in that competition. But in the improv world, because it's such a collaborative art form and you're lifting each other up, I would say in that world, you're not rooting against anyone. You know, you're definitely trying your best and rooting for yourself. But you very seldom do you find people rooting against someone else rather than, you know, they might be disappointed. It's interesting.
Speak
to see
for yourself, you altruistic alien. Who, you know, did your alien leaders forget to explain how it works on this planet? Did you see the movie last night?
I did, but I mean, even so, I mean, they were still rooting for each other.
Yeah, they were.
You know, and there's very much, there's a lot of that in that community.
Go ahead, Liz.
How about the exact scene that Mike chose to show, which I think is so brilliant, is that Chris Gethard's character, Bill, finds out his father's been in an accident. Mm-hmm. Keegan-Michael Key's character announces he got the audition, and Bill manages to say, amid his tears, do you know what bits you're going to do? How about this? Let me remind you of something that might make you get hired. That, to me, shows the love and support of each other, even when you're so jealous.
Yeah.
The film is Don't Think Twice, and you can see it at the Little Theater, and our panel is talking about the film and the themes. And let's work through the three prongs of improv, which will be a little bit old hat for our panel. I get it, but most of our listeners don't know them. And I think, to me, learning about them, it's very interesting to see how they worked in the film and the way they work in life, maybe outside of improv. So it starts with saying yes or saying, I guess Liz saying yes and?
Well, it's all yes. And I even take it a step before the actual word yes, which is a spirit of acceptance, a spirit of absorption, a spirit of, as I park my car and enter this theater, I'm going to start nodding my head up and down yes and accept whatever the world brings to me.
You want to elaborate on that, Jeffrey Sweet? Go ahead.
Sometimes people make a mistake in thinking that yes and means that you absolutely have to agree with the other person in terms of the point they're making in the scene. What you agree with is the foundation, the reality underneath whatever they're
exactly
saying.
Exactly.
There's a famous story of Joan Rivers at Second City, and it took her a while to get it, although she did eventually get it. And at one point, she was doing a scene with Bill Alton, and she said she wanted a divorce. And Bill Alton said, "Well, but what about the kids?" And Joan said, "We don't have any."
Ooh. Ooh.
And whenever anybody else denied a reality like that, somebody would say, "Oh, has Joan Rivers entered the room?" How she learned. And in fact, she ended up being a very good improviser, and she told me that being at Second City, while it was a lonely and difficult experience with her, because Del Close did not like her at all, Del Close was the great high guru for a while at Second City, she said that the whole basis of her career was what she learned. It was what she learned at Second City. But that idea of it's not just that you agree on the surface with what anybody says, you agree with the structure that's underneath what they've said. They've established a reality, and you say, oh, if he says, what about our children? We have children.
There you go.
If you're on if you're doing a scene saying, isn't it lovely to look at the ocean, the moon on the ocean, and somebody else says, well, I'm sure it is, but we're in the desert, they're contradicting a reality that's implicit in the first statement. Del used to say that any improviser worth their salt, no matter what the first line was, you could give a scene a direction with the second line. And I saw him do it once. He lined up a group of people, and he went down the row, and each person started with the first line. He came back quickly with the second line, which established the movement of the scene. And at the end of the line, there was a woman who decided she was going to mess with him by giving him the blandest line she could possibly give him. Mm. And she said, "Hello, Del." And he said, "Sure, you say that this morning."
If only Jeffrey had written books that we could learn from.
If only.
Which you could...
Oh, well, you could absolutely buy my absolutely wonderful book, or else you could come see me at the Rochester Fringe, because I'm telling stories about Del and Paul Sills and Viola Spolin and Mike Nichols, all of whom I knew.
Very good. Jeffrey's book, by the way, is something the characters are thumbing through in the movie, Something Wonderful Right Away. You're coming to the Fringe when? Do you have those dates offhand, Jeff?
I think it's like the 14th, 16th, and 17th. It's on the Fringe website. The name of the show is You Only Shoot the Ones You Love, which is a line Del said. There was a game in London where people were running around pretending to shoot each other, and you had to die spectacular deaths. And it was the Second City people and the Royal Shakespeare Company people, and Paul Sills was very irritated by this. He says, "Why aren't you kissing each other or hugging each other and sending a chain of love around London?" And Del told me, Paul never understood it. He said, "For God's sakes, you only shoot the ones you love." And so I borrowed the title.
Now, Caitlin Drago and John Forrest Thompson, I'm going to turn to you in studio to expand on the point of why we should say yes or say yes and. Our guests on the phone have talked about why it's vital in improv. I mean, obviously, if somebody says, you know, "How do you like this island?" but we're not on an island, all of a sudden the scene grinds to a halt and you got nothing to work with. But in real life, don't you think that this applies to it? Might not have been a central tenet of the film, but Caitlin, don't you know people in your life who you feel like they're always negative, you're always going to get a no or a reason to say no?
Yes.
See, I feel like step one where improv is life.
And that is where I found my professional life in Rochester. You know, so many of us, as we grow up, we build up these kind of walls of protection. When someone comes at us with a new idea that we're uncomfortable with, we immediately say no and reason, you know, this is why it's not going to work.
Sure.
Instead of taking a moment to actually even, not even necessarily say yes to it and go along with it, but to even authentically listen to what they're saying and consider it as a possibility. And so if we can learn to do that, you know, think of the wonderful new ideas and collaborative processes that we could experience in our lives. And to what they were talking about accepting the reality of the situation, mm-hmm. I think there's another piece there, and I think that everyone would agree that it's not just about accepting the reality, but it's about letting go of whatever great idea you may have stepped out on stage with and putting that on a shelf for a moment to support someone else.
And I guess, John Forrest Thompson, that's because you can't think too much. In fact, don't think. If you walk out on stage with an idea, but somebody comes to you with a different premise, you can't just step all over them with yours, right?
Right. And really, as an improviser, what you're trained to do is immediately and honestly dissect the moment that you're in, right, on stage at any given second, and then bring your background knowledge into what you know and filter that through a character. And really, you know, what Liz said is it starts way before the dialogue or the ideas. And, you know, in fact, Liz is a great teacher. She one of the things she taught me, and I still do it, I'm doing it now, is we weren't allowed to cross our arms or our legs in class.
Because everybody just looking around going like, what are my arms doing? What are my legs doing?
Right? And that was just, you're opening yourself up to the world. And it's a cliche, but being an improviser makes you a better person. It makes you vulnerable. It makes you honest. It makes you truly listen. Another exercise you do is make eye contact. And I know, Caitlin, you probably experienced this. Mm-hmm. People in the corporate world or in any other world, it's hard for them to make eye contact with another person for more than 10 seconds, you know? So it's these skills that you learn in improv, they make you a better person because you have to listen and you have to bring your ideas and support others.
And let me just follow and ask you, John, you know, you're learning how to bring your experience, but to try to react in that situation, to not think, to not come in with these preconceived ideas. I would think that is so difficult. I mean, if you listen to this program enough, you know that I quote from the wisdom of Ghostbusters a lot. I think of when Ray got all the blame for creating the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, but the premise was impossible. It was everybody clear your heads, don't think of anything, and then Gozer won't be able to conjure an image. Somebody's going to think of something eventually. You can't not think. You know, that's unfair. If it wasn't Ray, would have been Winston or somebody else, right?
Yeah, that's the big improv secret. And for me, that was the hump to get over, is you don't think, you react. And you trust yourself.
You feel.
Yes, you feel it. What you used to say, Liz, that the show was a cloud above us. And all you needed to do.
Oh, yes, it exists in the ether, and we channel it. And actually, I learned that directly from Dell. And can I take a moment to say what an honor it is to speak with Jeffrey Sweet?
Yes, right.
I'm honored. My heart is beating fast. But yes, Dell taught us, John, that everything was in the cloud above us, the ether above us, and we are the humble followers of what's been pre-created in the creative collective unconscious that floats above us. And, you know, these are ethereal concepts, but they work in reality. If you let go and let things flow through you as a group, that's when the gorgeous creations happen.
Can I just say a name here, which is frequently forgotten these days in this improv-saturated world, and to mention the person who really started it all, a woman named Viola Spolin, basically came up with the principles of improvisation as a byproduct of working with kids in the 1930s. She didn't want to boss the kids around. She wanted them to create material out of their own impulses and experiences, and so she came up with what she called theater games. And the theater games were the basis of the way her son, Paul Sills, directed, and then Paul Sills went on to create The Compass and The Second City and Story Theater. But there are an awful lot of people who are teaching improv who don't even know who Viola Spolin is and don't know that she was the beginning. She was the creator, one of the great figures in American theater.
Well, it is great to have Jeffrey Sweet, who's, you just heard there, playwright, performer, author of the book Something Wonderful Right Away, on with us. Liz Allen, an improv coach and author. Caitlin Drago's in studio, owner of Inspire Improv and Coaching. And John Forrest Thompson, who's an educator, improviser, and creative consultant. He is a member of Thank You Kiss, as is our producer, Megan Mack. And Megan Mack is the least self-promoting person who has maybe ever lived. And so she didn't even want me to mention this, but you can see Megan tomorrow. There's a screening and event tomorrow. So we're talking about Don't Think Twice, the new film that you can see at the Little Theater. And tomorrow night, 6:40, it's going to be a live podcast of Movies in a Microphone that begins following the movie. So, Meg, help me out here. 6:40 is the movie, and then Movies in a Microphone after it. All right, so 6:40 is the movie tomorrow night, Don't Think Twice. You can see it any night you want. But if you go tomorrow night at 6:40, you can see the film and then a live podcast of Movies in a Microphone. That's the Little Theater podcast. John is going to be on that panel. So John and Megan Mack will be on that panel, as well as Chelsea Flint, who is a Mike Birbiglia super fan. Scott Pukas is going to be there. And so we've got a full panel tomorrow night. We hope you can come out for that because it'll be an extension of the conversation, not only that you're hearing now, but a chance for you to weigh in on what you experienced with the film. So let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back with more of a discussion on these tenets of improv and how they relate to this remarkable film that is getting, and this is not, you know, sort of silly hyperbole, it's getting really wonderful reviews everywhere it goes, and it's in Rochester now. So let's get our break, and we'll come right back and talk about it. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connection, survey show millennials are having less sex than previous generations. Does this detonate some of the stereotypes about millennials? Well, the author of The Freshman Survival Guide says, for students going off to college, there are some things they should know about the world, and we'll talk about that with author Nora Bradbury Hale. Then in our second hour, pay to play at all levels of government. Talk to you then. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to ask another one of the coaches we have. Caitlin Drago's in studio, and we were just talking about how you learn not to think, or at least how to react more and shed yourself when you're in improv scenes of these preconceived notions of I'm going to do this in a scene, I'm going to say this, I like this kind of a character. And I, for some reason for me, my mind went back to when I was learning Spanish. And I remember being told eventually you will be able to think in Spanish and not, you know, think in your head, translate it, and then spit it out. And that took a long time, and I can't do it today. I'm rusty. Is it similar in improv where the more you do it, the more you are able to, within a scene, feel yourself less constricted by whatever preconceived thoughts you have and sort of roll more? Does it come with practice?
I think it does. And I think that it's not, it's about not trying to not think, but letting yourself say the first thing that comes instead of prejudging it before it comes out of your mouth. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the one time I took a class, I was a little paralyzed because I thought, well, I have to think a little. I have to have some quick pre-consideration because what I say might not be funny. And that's not the point. You're not trying to be funny, right?
Exactly.
You know, I, and Megan Mack, who was coaching me, told me, you're not trying to be funny. You're not here trying to put on some sort of a super show with every line. And as soon as you give that up, it'll be easier. And I guess by the end, I was mildly better, even though I thought I was horrible. Liz, is it normal to feel horrible at this when you start out?
Yes, it's normal
to
feel horrible for years when you learn to improvise because it takes years to learn it. Mm-hmm. Being an improviser is accepting that you're going to feel like crap for a really long time about yourself because you're going to put a bar way high that you think you have to reach, but you don't. You're already at the bar when you sign up for a class, meaning the bar, the level. You're already amazing, and it is already something wonderful right away when you sign up for class because you're entering a universe of relinquishing and submitting, and if you can learn about yourself that just being is fantastic, then you'll save yourself a lot of anguish learning to improvise.
I'm supposed to say yes, and I'm going to say no, but I was really bad. So I'm going to say no, but I was legitimately bad.
You're improvising every day on the radio.
Yeah.
Jeffrey, go ahead. I know you wanted to weigh in on that too.
Well, I was just going to say that some of the people we think of the great classic improvisers took years before they felt the feet, the ground beneath their feet. Mike Nichols told me that, in fact, he never felt it with anybody but Elaine May. He could not improvise with anybody else, that it was their special connection. And, of course, they ended up they were the first star performers of improv to make people aware of what this kind of work was like. There's some people who can improvise with everybody, and there's some people like Mike who could only improvise with Elaine.
That is interesting. Oh, my goodness.
Well, I mean, you know, John, you were just reacting too. I mean, isn't it true that any one of us, if we were in improv and we were really making a run at it, you click a little bit more with certain people, or do you find that you've been able to click with just about anybody you've performed with, John?
I think that ebbs and flows. You know, I think you definitely find people who you click with a little bit more. You know, the team, the commune that's in the movie, they're like a lot of teams that are house teams or something like that have been together for a long time. They live together. You know, newer teams that you might get on where you don't know people, you might have some competition. You may just not click with them at all. So I think it is really the more time you spend with somebody, the more you'll get to know each other's nuances.
It helps to have a shared reference level. The original Second City and Compass people, most of them were either graduates or droppers out or hangers-on at the University of Chicago, and they were all ferociously well-read and ferociously smart and brought all these references to the work. It's nice to have some kind of shared reference points that people can speak in shorthand.
I would just say as well, John, I'd love to hear from you on this. I mean, I've found essentially in my own life, no clicking at all with Megan Mack on a work level. Have you been able to overcome that?
Absolutely.
On an improv level.
Yeah. The good thing is that Megan writes 90% of our stuff, and then we yes. get to add our little funny things to it. So she's the workhorse, and we're kind of the lazy people. But, you know, so that definitely works for me, you know.
My goal is to make her as uncomfortable as possible. It's absolutely working. If you can see, I'm getting a thumbs up from producer Megan Mack on that. I want to talk about the third aspect of improv that the film covers and sort of the hallmarks are. We've talked about say yes, don't think. It's all about the group is the third one. And this is something I think can take us home this hour because it's not just about improv. It's about friendship. And that's what this film is about. The film's Don't Think Twice. That's what we're talking about. Jeffrey Sweet, when we say it's all about the group, you know, hey, if you haven't worked in improv, you might say, what's the big deal if somebody on some occasion, you know, on some scene wants to throw a character in? You had one of the characters in the film right away when things weren't clicking. He decided, or when he thought there was somebody important in the audience, he's going to do his best Barack Obama, which was a good Obama, by the way. What's wrong with that?
I saw him do the Obama at second.
It's really good.
Years ago, Keegan. So I thought, yeah, that's a good Obama. He's going to use that. I saw it almost 10 years ago in Second City.
But what's wrong with that? Give me a sense for why.
Because you're imposing on the others. You're dragging them to your reality rather than sharing in a shared reality. You're supposed to jointly create something, not to impose. And there have been people over the years. Mostly the people get along, but there were a handful of people. David Steinberg, who was at Second City, told me that apologetically, and he's since made up with the people that he did this to, that he would use the other people as props.
Right.
That he would come on stage and he would just do what he was going to do, and because he was very fast and very funny, for years he and Robert Klein didn't speak to each other. They finally had become friends. But you had Robert Klein, David Steinberg, and Fred Willard all on the same stage. And Steinberg ran away because he was determined to use this as a springboard to become a star, and did.
And wasn't
he was not beloved.
Go ahead, John.
You guys know better than I, but one of Dell's tenets was, if you want to build a cathedral, don't bring a cathedral, bring a brick, right? And
Absolutely.
And that's really that whole concept. So if you're bringing Barack Obama, that's kind of bringing your own cathedral and inviting everybody in. But bring a brick, and we'll all set a brick, and we'll build it together.
And can I weigh in on the Barack thing, too?
Yeah.
When Keegan's character makes that choice, he's completely serving himself in that moment of time. And what we aim for is to everybody always serve the group first and then serve yourself. So he took energy away from the group by serving himself first in that moment.
Liz, there is a routine that the group has before every performance when they're kind of going out. We're talking about the commune, this group of half a dozen performers in the film. They're always saying, got your back, got your back. Is that a normal thing in improv? Is that sort of an industry thing?
Oh, I wouldn't say it's an industry thing, but I would say every group has their ritual, if you will. Maybe they consider it a good luck, bad luck situation, but it's a reminder, anything that's a touchstone for the group to remember that no matter what, when we're out there, I have your back, which is also what makes the Barack Obama choice so dissatisfying for other improvisers to watch, because in that very moment of time, he didn't necessarily have their back, and he didn't care. He did it anyway.
Let me ask Caitlin and Jennifer.
He's got two impulses at war with each other. One is to, you know, be on stage with his friends and to do the work, and the other impulse is to advance himself.
Right.
And they are mutually exclusive impulses, and you're watching a civil war going on in this guy. And in that case, the bad side won.
Yeah, in the film, it is an uncomfortable scene, to say the least, and Caitlin, I'll put you on the spot a little bit.
Sure.
Not to name names, but have you been in that position? Have you seen that happen?
Oh, of course. I think every improviser has. But to explore it from the other side, when you are able to, you know, like we say, make each other look good or look for ways to set one another up for success, it takes that bit of stress of, I'm going to walk out on stage in front of an audience and I don't know what's going to happen. It takes some of that stress away because you know that there's a whole group of people who are there to support no matter what comes out of your mouth, and you're going to do the same for them. And we talked about, you know, feeling that click, and I feel like improv is the great click maker. When I first moved back to Rochester, the first fast friends that I made were over at the space doing improv, because when you're in a situation where you're walking on stage and don't know what's going to happen, you have to completely trust the people around you. So it immediately creates those strong, strong bonds. And that's what you saw in the movie there.
Yeah. John, let's do a little improv then, right? Okay.
Sure.
So so you've been in that situation, right? Where you've seen people do that?
Absolutely.
And their name is?
Megan Mack.
All right. So very realistically, John, as a performer, what we saw in the film was frustration from the rest of the group. They're mm-hmm. watching Keegan-Michael Key, who does a great Obama, but he's stealing that scene. He's doing it for himself. It starts to impact their friendship, too. And I'm wondering if you've seen the dynamics here. Are improv performers natural friends, or is it tough to have friendships for those reasons?
I think naturally you're friends because you go through, if you go through a program like IO or UCB, you're spending 18 months in class, which is, you know, similar to a master's degree. And during that time, you're watching shows, you are living with those people. I think 5B is the last level, and you have 5B shows at IO. I think we had between the two classes about 30 students at our time. And after our last 5B shows to let off steam, we were at a house party, and I think 20 people were in the shower together, and probably 2/3 of those were wearing clothes, you know. So it's like summer camp.
Did not turn in the direction
yeah.
I thought.
No. It's like summer camp kind of with, you know, alcohol and theater and at times. But then again, you know, as a house manager at IO, I did see those showcases where people would get picked, and Lauren Michaels and Daily Show people. And there was one year where it was the year that Vanessa Bayer and Paul Britton got picked for SNL. And I think a guy named Dan Bacadall ended up writing for The Daily Show. And the buzz around the theater afterwards was nobody felt like Vanessa or Paul didn't deserve it because they're really good at what they do. But I think the feeling was, wow, that wouldn't have been my first choice or who I thought. I mean, when at that time, Holly Laurent and Jet Evelith and Pat O'Brien, there were some really powerhouse people within the community who you thought, oh, they'll probably get the shot. So I think Vanessa was kind of an underdog at the time and Paul was an underdog, but nobody was unhappy that they got it or thought that they didn't deserve it. But I'm sure with those groups, you know, there were probably some people who thought, yeah, I think I'm better than that person, and some
sure,
disappointment.
Sure. And so if you see the film, which is shown at the Little Theater, we're talking about Don't Think Twice, the new film from Mike Birbiglia that is about improv comedy, yes, but it's about friendship and these dynamics at play. There are tough moments when these things start to spin. You have Jack, the character played by Keegan-Michael Key. He gets the gig at essentially the SNL of the film, and they're happy but it's tough, and they see him acting in ways they don't love. He comes back I guess it was a party with Ben Stiller, and he felt like the group feels like he's kind of talking down to them, and things are starting to change. Mike Birbiglia's character is frustrated because he has trained a lot of these people, and he's seeing them surpass some of his success as a writer and as a performer. He is frustrated with that. He's writing, trying to get in as a writer to the show. Two of the others in the cast are trying to get in. And then somebody does get a writing gig, and it is, to me, the most uncomfortable moment of the entire film is when one of the women who reveals that she got this job, Mike Birbiglia's character reacts instantly with total frustration. They have it out. And the question is sort of, can those friendships be salvaged in those moments? And Liz, I want to start with you, and I want to ask everybody this here, but this is the moment of the film that I thought, this is why that improv tenet, it's all about the group, matters so much. Because if you really want to be a supportive person in your life, and you don't want to just be a self-promoter, you want these moments to come with celebration as much as possible. There's nothing wrong with a little jealousy or envy, but that was tough. That moment was really hard for me to watch, and it had me in the last 12, 24 hours reflecting on how I treat friends who are successful. And maybe
wow,
that was part
really?
Of the point. Yeah, I think so, and I think that's maybe what Birbiglia is going for.
Well, I agree. I thought it was a beautiful moment, and it was so realistic. I've lived that moment. I've seen that happen between people. I understand why it's a moving scene to watch. This, all that you've been talking about here just in the last few minutes about friendship and this moment of how do you respond to your friends who's successful. What draws people to improv, I think, is we all have something to say. We want to say what's inside us. That's why we're not choosing to necessarily spend our time doing plays or scripts. We have so much to say inside of us. We want to be heard. And the great thing about improv is it teaches you to listen first. So we all want to speak and be heard, but we're taught, hold off, someone has to go first. Someone always has to go first, and then eventually we all get heard. But when it gets so sharp and recognized when someone else is heard so much that they're hired, we have such a reaction because we're supposed to say, great, you first, but it hurts so bad, and that scene captures all those complicated emotions.
Yeah, and Liz, have you had students who will come in and say, I'm going to be the next Tina Fey, I'm going to be the next Amy Poehler, or they come in and they're immediately not getting the group concept and they're throwing weight around in a way that you can see is not going to work?
100%. I see that in the first 4 minutes of mini classes. Absolutely.
And how do you work that out of them?
Well, first, you have to slowly invite them to the concept that their words matter, but other people's matter first in the moment of creating collaborative art. So you have to invite them to a new way of thinking. And you have to help them learn some humility, and it's very difficult. Some people simply can't do it, and the way that I invite people to leave a training center, and it's only happened a few times over the years, but I tell them that maybe they're just not meant for group art and they need to go do something solo creative, be creative in a solo fashion, because group art is so about learning humility. What I find is those people that make the big declarations up front are usually the most insecure and then are oddly the most grateful that someone like a teacher takes the time to help them see how they're being blind about themselves. And then if you invite people down this path, and then they experience what's so amazing about group art, they let go of their dreams of stardom, and they actually become the most invested. That's usually what happens. But when people make those declarations up front, I chuckle and think, look out.
But Jeffrey Sweet, there will be people who not only see this movie, but hear this discussion and think, improv sounds like something very different than SNL, where these bits work on SNL,
yeah,
they don't work
and,
in improv.
I want to make one point before, which is that from the point of view of SNL, they may not have chosen what some of the others thought were the best people who were at I.O. at the time, but SNL was looking at how to fill in the gaps in their cast. So they came in not with an objective, looking for an objective standard of who was best, but what they needed to make their ensemble. So you always have to remember that. But one thing that I'd like to point out is that this is... There's a long history of people being loyal to their friends in this, that as people out of improv rise, they tend to like to, and they have the power to build their own projects, they tend to like to work with the people that they've worked with best. So you'll see, years after they were at Second City together, you'll see Steve Carell and Adam McKay working together. You'll see, Tina continuing to work with Rachel Dratch, with whom she did a sensational two-person show way before anybody knew them. People are pretty loyal to each other, I find.
I agree. I agree with that.
I have a play opening in February, and the director I'm choosing, and she's making her off-Broadway debut, the director is a woman named Megan Fay, who's an old buddy from Second City. I've worked with tons of Second City people simply because, as Alan Arkin once said, the Second City actor doesn't say, well, what's in it for me? They say, what's the story and how do I help?
And the Lonely Island story is another interesting one. In fact, Megan Mack, maybe you and I can find, and I'll post on my Twitter feed, I read a pretty interesting article not too long ago, a few months back, on the history of Lonely Island, which is, you know, Andy Samberg and a couple of his very good friends who he has written with, and then they did a lot of videos and music together. And the article also sort of sidetracks into some very interesting things about how they consider themselves feminists. I mean, it's really interesting stuff. But that friendship has endured, and so that's just another example. So it was through Vulture. Okay, so we'll find it and post it on our Twitter feeds if you want to check that out. But John and Caitlin, who are in studio with us, I'm looking at the dynamics of this film, the friendships that form, and. Have you, Liz talks about having to tell, kind of tell somebody this is going to be better for you, a solo career is better for you. Have you seen people do what happened in the film, which is, okay, if I can't get this job, maybe I can write for you. You know, that got kind of awkward in the film too, where Keegan-Michael Key goes to work for the show and the rest of the group saying, hey, can you send the scripts in? Is that realistic? Does that happen? Or would they at least have the self-awareness to know that would be tough for him in his first year to be try to get us in the door there? What do you think, John?
Yeah. And I think, I don't know for sure, but I do know that. I mean, even from time to time, there's a couple people that are on SNL now, and I knew them fairly well when I was at I.O.
Are you calling them going, hey, man?
Yeah, but that's the thing. I would think, I would never call him to get tickets.
See,
because
you're you.
I know. We've talked about this. John's different.
So I don't know. I guess myself, I wouldn't do that because I would know it's a new job. I think even outside of improv, you know, a guy gets hired, you're hoping, wow, I want to get on there, you know. Megan Mack. And I think that was an interesting side of the film as well, to see that pressure when he got to Weekend Live, just to see what a small fish he was, and his, you know, the office mate was like, don't even think it, you know. He had to learn a whole new set of rules, and that push and pull between, you know, telling his friends of course he wants to advocate for him, you know,
and knowing that he might not even be able to ask.
Right.
You know,
and go ahead, Liz.
Well, I was just going to say, this is what's so hard about understanding that when you decide to improvise, you have to trust that everything that improv is going to bring you is going to come to you on improv's time frame, not yours. And you have to trust that you can only shake the tree so much. You have to believe that improv is going to bring you what it's going to bring you, and maybe don't go after it too hard, and it will come to you. And that's a hard life lesson.
The other thing I would say is that sometimes what it brings you is not what you anticipate. There are an enormous number of people who started off in improv and did not make their careers in improv, but what they learned from improv informed their later careers. David Mamet was a busboy at Second City, and if you take a look at his early plays, he obviously learned from improv. Sexual Perversity in Chicago and Glengarry Glen Ross are written by somebody who absorbed the rhythms of improv. There were a lot of people that you don't know who are doing very well in the business as writers, and they write out of improv principles. Almost every theory, every game that Viola Spolin created can be converted into a writing principle and can inform your writing. So the index of success is not if you get on SNL. The index of success is, does it lead you to work that you do and you do well and that you love?
Improv led me to teaching. I didn't know I was going to be so fulfilled by teaching. I had no idea. And look at the loyalty Mike Birbiglia kept for me. Here we are 20 years later after we first met, and he kept me in the back of his mind. That's just beautiful, and that's how improv works.
And I was going to say, Liz, that's a perfect example of a life lesson. Like,
no kidding.
Wait for improv. Wait to see what it brings you instead of jumping all over it. It's the same thing you learn in level one improv. Wait for the scene to unfold in front of you. Don't force it. And that's really perfectly exemplifies how it applies on stage and then off.
And
as
in
well.
Life. I mean, in the film, there was another great moment where you talk about trying to force it, get us in, you're a friend, bring this script. And one of the characters says to Mike Birbiglia, you know, maybe you should focus on the work, not your connections. You know, do better work. That was a great, so that applies way beyond improv. So I thought that was pretty profound. And then those questions of, well, it's not all about getting on SNL. One of the characters in the film kind of concludes that she's happy where she is. She doesn't want to be on SNL. It's not for her. And so Caitlin Drago, who does improv coaching, you probably have people just like Megan Mack or anybody else who teaches and coaches comedy who isn't coming because that's what they want to do for life, but they see the skills as valuable, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I actually work primarily with non-actors, folks who are in the corporate world. And for me, you know, when we were talking about wait to see what improv brings you and what you mentioned in the beginning of, you know, if I leave Los Angeles, I failed. One of the things that brought me a lot of solace was someone said to me, you know, it's okay to dream different dreams. And I didn't know what that next step would be. But once you have improv in your soul, you can't help but have it be part of your life in some way. And that's how it's shown up here as I moved and made a new professional life in Rochester, working with non-actors and helping them to see, oh, I am creative, and this is what I can learn from listening to my coworkers, and letting improv seep in a different way.
Hey, Liz Allen, you got any ins with Mike Birbiglia? I want him on the show sometime.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, what
I'll,
can you do for
I'll
me
call
now?
Him and book him for 2 p.m. today.
I want to talk to that guy because Mike Birbiglia and I have the same sleep condition. He went through.
Oh, you're kidding me!
He went through a window. I went over a staircase. We both survived.
Come on, this is such a rare condition, and you have it as well.
I'm not lying to you. It's and my wife's going, I cannot believe you're saying this on the air. But I thought that would be my in with Mike, and that did not work. So I'm going to try that.
Oh my goodness! I can't believe you. First of all, I just must say congratulations to you for any night's sleep you ever get.
It's better now, you know. I mean, but you learn to deal with it. But the bottom line is, it's not about me. But I'm just saying, you know, somebody let Birbiglia know. He and I got to talk because he is amazing. And listeners, if you have not heard of him, he's saying, I keep hearing this Birbiglia. He really is remarkable. His comedy's great. You've heard him on This American Life. And look up his stuff about his sleep disorder. Look up his stuff about the car accident, returning to the scene of the crime. He is a remarkable storyteller. Look at what's happened. This hour has vanished, but all the things we've discussed you can find in the film. So tomorrow, 6:40, you can see Don't Think Twice and the live podcast of Movies and a Microphone. My colleague Megan Mack will be there. John Forrest Thompson will be there. Go check that out. And if you can't go tomorrow at 6:40, you can see the film at the Little Theater this week. Liz Allen's work is represented. It has been a great pleasure talking to you, Liz. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jeffrey Sweet, the book is Something Wonderful Right Away, and you can see him at the Fringe Festival coming up. Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time as well.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Caitlin Drago, where to find you online?
InspireImprov.com.
InspireImprov.com. John Forrest Thompson, they're going to find you where?
Thank You Kiss on Facebook. And we'll be at Blackfriars September 17th and 23rd.
You're even worse than Megan at this. So Thank You Kiss is on Facebook if you want to check out his group. Great pleasure. Thank you, John. Nice seeing you
as well.
Thank
you. It was a pleasure.
Rob, Megan Mack, thank you so much. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon.